going to be looking at, first thing I'll make a presence of the Williams and the United States, the Williams, the Baker and the Sylvester. And this one is just to give you an idea of how prevalent some of these mental disorders are. We're going to be looking at the depression, which is essentially a mood disorder. And part of this, lifetime prevalence is only 20%. Anxiety disorders would be close to 30%. Some literature indicates these are probably on the same spectrum, so a patient starts out with an anxiety disorder, and if it's not totally treated, they may proceed and end up in the depression category. Again, I'm looking at some of the major problems with the mental disorder. We're covering, again, the antidepressants in this next section. So these will be agents that are used in the treatment of major depression. But they're also used for panic disorders, and obsessive compulsive disorders, and there are a lot of anxiety disorders are treated with antidepressants. People that are bipolar, antidepressant disorder, they used antidepressants in the past. Currently, they're not recommended as sole agents. If you use the antidepressants, you push people into the manic phase. And also, there's some indications that the antidepressants really aren't that effective in people that have bipolar disorder. I don't think this one is in the handout either, but all it's looking at is the genetic predisposition. So here's your major depression out here. If you have a first degree relative that has major depression, a sibling or a parent, you're at 2 to 5 times higher risk for developing major disorder, major depression yourself. If you look at how many people that have major depression is due to their heredity, it's about a third. And it has a major contribution. So here's the first CPS question. Most of the agents that we're going to be covering will increase the amount of neurotransmitters that are available, but just increasing the amount of neurotransmitter isn't the explanation as to how the compounds produce their effect. They just see a more immediate increase in the neurotransmitters, but it takes a period of time for the compounds to produce their antidepressant effect. Could be a week to a month. So it's not an immediate effect. So it's not just the deficiency of the compounds. Just to say that they're not involved. When you think of depression, you think in terms of the symptoms that are listed on this slide. Person's sad, doesn't have a sense of pleasure, they're overwhelmed, they're anxious, can't concentrate, and probably guilt. What they're recognizing is that people that are depressed also have a lot of somatic symptoms. And you see in a couple of slides, this is in many cases what actually takes the person to the physician. They don't go saying I'm depressed. They go because of the aches and pains, the headaches, they can't sleep, the tired, changes in appetite, that pain, and so on. So it's somatic symptoms. So this is looking at primary care physicians, in other words, not psychiatrists, but the internal medicine physicians. And that's actually what people went to see the physician for. So again, chief complaint, like 70% of the patients were the somatic symptoms, physical presentation. One of the problems with these agents is they're not going to be effective for everyone. It can be very difficult to find the right agents to use. The importance of this is if a person doesn't overcome the symptoms of depression, they end up relapsing. And many of these people that had these lingering symptoms were the ones that also had the physical symptoms. So it's not good enough to take a person so they feel somewhat better if you want to try to get to the point where they're not actually depressed anymore. This could be very difficult to do. I've had way too much experience with antidepressants. My daughter had major depression from about 7th grade, so she became a senior in high school. And she's finally to the point where she's not depressed every day or every hour of the night. But it was a long battle. The main neurotransmitters that we will be looking at will be the serotonin and the norepinephrine. The major effects are shown. So in this circle, we have the effects for serotonin, this one for norepinephrine. Our pitch in the middle is where both neurotransmitters are involved. So this is, some people may respond better to agents that target serotonin, others that agents that target the norepinephrine, some that target both, so you can't necessarily predict ahead of time. The pharmacology class will cover more of the specific parts of the CNS that are involved. The only thing I want you to pick out of this one is the fact that the pathways for the serotonin and the norepinephrine are targeting the same parts of the CNS. So, therefore, as you might expect, you will see interaction, and it's difficult to sort out which pathway is being affected. The part that's in the spinal cord here gets involved in things like pain perception. Some of the antidepressants are actually used in the treatment of pain. Looking at the neurotransmitters again. Notice this says the dysregulation of the pathways being associated with depression, not an efficiency. So in the spinal cord again, pain perception. So it's more imbalances rather than not having enough of one or the other neurotransmitter. I mentioned most of the agents that we will be looking at will target either serotonin or norepinephrine or both of them. But there is a third neurotransmitter, the dopamine, and it shows its function and it overlaps with these other neurotransmitters. So again, things like mood, emotion, cognitive function depend on all three neurotransmitters. This comes from one of the programs in the Medscape. If you're interested in references, they have them listed on the bottom of the slide. You look at them after they're posted in Paris Connect, you look at the notes section. So again, we're looking at all three neurotransmitters, norepinephrine, serotonin, and dopamine. But there's a lot of other compounds that are also present in the CNS that are probably involved with depression, which is a critical troponin releasing factor. It's a peptide hormone that regulates the secretion of ACTH, and it's also a neurotransmitter in the CNS. And there's an over secretion of the peptide hormone in people that are depressed. That's another compound that may be seen targeted in the future. Most of the compounds that we'll be looking at, we won't mention it, but people that are studying the depression is one of the compounds that's been on the front burner as we look at causes. And then other neurotransmitters that are involved, the GABA, substance B, so on. So it's not to say that the norepinephrine, serotonin, and dopamine are the only compounds. These are some slides that just show how the different neurotransmitters are altered, just to say that they're not normal. So this first one is looking at norepinephrine. So there's a decrease in the reuptake of the norepinephrine. And there's an increase in the density and affinity of the alpha-2 receptors in the frontal cortex. So the alpha-2 receptors are the ones that regulate the release of neurotransmitters, the presynaptic ones, so we know the results of inhibition, and then upregulation of beta receptors. And one of the ways that you pick up that the levels of norepinephrine are not normal is to look at the metabolites. So what you find is a decrease in urinary levels, which would indicate potentially a decrease in the norepinephrine. When you're looking at urinary levels, it doesn't necessarily say it's coming from the CNS. Serotonin levels, again, decrease in the metabolite of serotonin. In this case, we're looking at the cerebral spinal cord, and that's kind of correlated with what's happening in the CNS. And decrease in the transporter to take the serotonin back into the neurons. It's usually difficult to study what's going on in the CNS, but in the case of the serotonin, they can look at what's happening in platelets as a model. And then an increase in the density of the receptors. When you look at serotonin, there's a number of different receptors, like 7 different categories of receptors. And then some of them have subpopulations like AD and so on. When you look at depression, then usually they're looking at the 5-HT2 receptors. Some of the compounds will also attack 5-HT1 receptors. And then dopamine. MDD is a major depressive disorder. You have decrease in the metabolites. You have increase in the binding. Decrease in the transporter. So yeah, main thing, abnormal conditions for all three neurotransmitters. I don't know that I have this one in your handout. Is it there in the, again, usually in the past, we focus on the neurotransmitters. What this is showing is other compounds that we've been focusing on. This is your clinical troponin releasing hormone. And it has receptors in the CNS. It's also the peptide that stimulates the production of the ACTH, that stimulates the adrenal gland, that's producing glucocorticoids. So glucocorticoids get impact on the CNS. And then the BDNF is a neurotrophic factor. This is a peptide hormone that's involved in the synthesis of neurons. Again, this is a major focus for potential therapy in the future. We have a number of different cytokines that can affect these other compounds. The main thing is depression isn't simple. Most people don't have the skills that they have the service staff, even just normal PowerPoint. Be scared of that. That would really scare the dog. Volume of this. They have mentioned that depression is often caused just by lack of the neurotransmitters. When we look at most of the therapeutic agents, they're going to be increasing levels, particularly of norepinephrine and serotonin. We can do that either by inhibiting the metabolism, like the monoamine oxidase inhibitors, or inhibiting the reuptake pumps. Problem is, this usually occurs fairly rapidly for the agents that we're using. As I mentioned, it usually takes time for antidepressants to produce the effect, like at least a week, sometimes 2-3 weeks. So they looked at how do you explain that. So they got into this down-regulation hypothesis, so that when you increase the amount of the neurotransmitters, the receptors end up being desensitized. And some of the ones that are involved are listed here. And then the newer theories are looking at the actual cellular interaction between the different parts of the CNS as the explanation. And I think that's what's important, not just increasing the concentration of the neurotransmitters. So this is looking at the normal situation where you have the neurons, which have normal growth and survival. When a person is under a lot of stress, like anxiety, and as I mentioned, anxiety frequently leads to depression, you get an increase in the production of the glucocorticoids, and that leads to a decrease in the brain-derived neurotrophic factor. So what happens is you lose neurons, and you lose the connections from the neurons. When a person's on the antidepressants, you increase the concentration of the neurotransmitters, you end up increasing the brain-derived neurotrophic factor and decrease the glucocorticoids. So it's this increased growth and survival of the neurons that they think might explain why the compounds take that week to 3 weeks to produce their effect. It takes time for the neurons to reestablish the connection. But a little bit on what the FDA was about including antidepressants. A lot of these compounds have received a lot of negative publicity because they've been kind of over-promoted by drug companies. But what the FDA has required is you have to have 2 positive tests where you have a randomized control trial. You've got a population that you accept. Put it into 2 groups. In most cases, they're not going to compare 2 compounds. They're a new compound versus an older compound. Usually, they're testing it against a placebo. In many cases, you don't have a definite answer as a result of the trial. In other words, it doesn't show an improvement, but it wasn't worse. So those studies don't count against the drug. Failed studies doesn't mean that the placebo was better. It's just that the drug wasn't really worse than the placebo. And if you look at the contemporary tests, actually half of them didn't show that the drug was more effective. Now, it's not easy to show necessarily the effectiveness because a lot of these are short-term tests, and a lot of them don't have a real large number of patients that are being treated. So when they do the test, they may only be using them for, say, 3 months. Compounds don't cause a robust overcoming of the depression. It's harder to measure the effectiveness. There's an awful lot of people that respond to placebos, especially when you're looking at short-term administration. Just the fact that you're receiving something, in many cases people have hope, and so therefore you see a beneficial effect. There's many people that don't take the drugs like they should, and that's difficult to measure, but you can't really say the drug is ineffective if the person didn't take it. So you end up losing patients to be studied. And again, because we have not a real large population, it's difficult to get statistically meaningful studies. So this is looking at, we studied, this part here is the part that would respond, to a placebo. And these are the people that wouldn't respond to the placebo that did respond to the drug. So we get the people that respond, and we have the people that are being studied, but a lot of them wouldn't respond to the placebo. So it's hard to sort that out. These are the people that didn't complete the study. There are people that won't respond to any of the agents that are treatment resistant. And then you have the non-responders that didn't respond to this one, but may have responded to another one. One of the problems with people that don't continue in the study is they usually look at, well, is the person safe at the time that they dropped out? This is just looking at general treatment with antidepressants. So, primary care physician writes a prescription for an antidepressant. Anywhere from 1/4 to 1/3 of the patients don't take it for a month. Again, it takes that long to see the effect of the drug. More than 40% drop out within 3 months. And then a lot of people never get to the point where they're actually at therapeutic levels. They get into some of the compounds. It takes, because of the real long half-life of the compound, it takes a while for the compound to build up, produce a therapeutic level. This gets into the role of the pharmacist as far as counseling the patient. The fact that they need to take the patient to the drug on a regular basis, and that it's not going to give them an immediate response. It's going to take 3 or 4 weeks to see the beneficial effect. And then if they are feeling better, they should continue to take it. So a lot of people, as soon as they feel better at the end of 2 weeks, they get the cure, so they quit taking it, and then the depression reoccurs. It's not to say they have to take it forever, but you don't want to just continue within a short period of time. This lists some of the additional uses of the compounds other than just in the treatment of depression. So again, these were the anxiety disorders. The place where the antidepressants doesn't work is like a specific holiness. And one of the difficult things with the antidepressants is there's an awful lot of different mechanisms of action with these compounds. So that's one of the things we need to look at as far as putting the compounds into categories. So we're trying to compare them, what are they doing. We're going to look at the monoamine oxidase inhibitors first. Then we'll look at the tricyclics. These are compounds that particularly tertiary tricyclic compounds. They block the reuptake of serotonin and norepinephrine, but they also affect a lot of other receptors. So you see more side effects. The SSRIs became very popular when they were introduced because they had fewer side effects. But going to be more selective with just serotonin, not to affect the norepinephrine. And we give compounds that are selective for just norepinephrine and compounds that give both. And we're getting the compounds that can block receptors as well as inhibiting reuptake. Compounds that target dopamine, those aren't very common. Most of them are going to target the norepinephrine and serotonin. So we don't have too many that target dopamine in addition to another neurotransmitter. And down on the end, we're looking at the compounds that may come on the market in the future. Mentioned that the glucocorticoids are increased in people that have depression, so they may be trying to antagonize their effect, decrease their production. Corticotropin releasing factor antagonist, and that was overproduced, people that were depressed. First group are the monoamine oxidase inhibitors. We covered this one first in part because these were the first compounds that were on the market. Notice that they're not very common to be used. So this was a projection back in 2005 that only about 0.1% of all antidepressant prescriptions were for monoamine oxidase inhibitors. There's been some review articles written that basically says that maybe they're underused, that physicians are worried about the side effects of the compounds too much. So how they were developed, they were initially looking at the INH, this methylated acid hydrolyte, as far as the treatment of tuberculosis, and what they found was that when the compound was used, it could affect the mood. Compound was relatively poor, so what they did is try and increase the liposolubility. If you want to increase mood, you want the compound to get into the CNS. Compound wasn't used for the treatment for tuberculosis, now to initially with the idea of treating depression. So when we look at monoamine oxidase, we looked at them and looked at that. The material that was on the second exam. This is the enzyme that will convert your biological amine to the aldehyde, so you're inactivating them by deamination. The neurotransmitters we're interested in, norepinephrine and serotonin and dopamine. The enzyme is found throughout the body, not just in the CNS. So you find it in the GI tract, the liver, and other places in the body. Normal function is to regulate the levels of amines that you obtain in your diet, trying to prevent them from producing more fat. So if you have exogenous amines that you consume, they're normally destroyed before they do anything. And that's why you see the levels like in the GI tract and in the liver. We looked at the effect like in the CNS, metabolizing the neurotransmitters. Remember that in most cases, compounds like the norepinephrine's action was terminated by the reuptake into the neurons rather than by the metabolism. And we're going to be looking at two different forms of monoamine oxidase, an A and a B. B is more involved in metabolism of dopamine and more in the CNS than the peripheral system. If we inhibit monoamine oxidase, we expect to see profound effects on norepinephrine markers. The answer was no. Because remember, you're normally terminating the effect by re-update. No, I can see the hole in it, the hydrolyzing, right in the synapse. Shows you the structure for serotonin. We've got the monitor covering serotonin with some of the leaves that she covered, right? So good. Main thing is, it does have an amine and be a substrate for monoamine oxidase. It's not a substrate for COMT because we don't have caterpillar in the molecule. This is showing its metabolism. Deamination, which is the aldehyde is oxidized to the acid. This is your 5-hydroxyamino acetic acid that was measured within the spinal fluid. This is an indication of the amount of serotonin in the CNS. So of the two forms for monoamine oxidase, they are different molecular entities. They're coded for by different genes. They have different distribution in the body. In the intestinal tract, the predominant form is the monoamine oxidase A. In the CNS, there's a lot of the monoamine oxidase B, and this is involved in the metabolism of dopamine. They do differ in their substrate specificity and the compounds that are capable of inhibiting them. Compounds that will be inhibitors are going to contain amines. You might expect, since that's the target for the molecule. When you look at the metabolism of the neurotransmitters that we're interested in, again, the serotonin and the norepinephrine are metabolized more by monoamine oxidase A. Dopamine can be metabolized by either, so it's generally the case in terms of more metabolism by B. Focus of that is the compounds that we're going to be looking at end up being able to inhibit both forms, monoamine oxidase A and B. Probably use this one for you. It's a relatively recent one. We're going to talk about the problem with the tyramine that you obtain in the diet. Remember that normally if you have exogenous amines in your diet, the monoamine oxidase should destroy it before it does anything. So this is looking at the metabolism in the small intestine, the monoamine oxidase A and B, and then this is the metabolism in the liver, A and B. So here it's like 80% A and 20% B, and it's like 50-50. So if we have compounds that are inhibiting the enzyme, they're not going to be metabolized with the tyramine that's obtained in the diet. So we end up with higher concentrations in the circulation. And these can reach the synapse, the neurons in the CNS, and they can release the neurotransmitters. So A, again, affects the metabolism of serotonin and the norepinephrine. If we block the enzyme, we end up having more of the neurotransmitter incorporated into the vesicles in order to release. Again, remember, we're not having the enzyme on here in the synapse itself. And the dopamine, again, monoamine oxidase, but it's more of a deform. And again, the enzyme is not in the synapse, but rather in the neuron. So it's after you take it back up into the neuron that you're preventing the metabolism. Of the compounds that we're looking at that are antidepressants that are used in the U.S., they're, again, nonspecific. They have monoamine oxidase A and B. miserable, they could be self-serving. Compound was marketed for a period of time in the treatment of Parkinson's. It's an orally active compound. And essentially, we're getting more of an inhibition of mildly oxidative wheat with the oral dosage form. The antidepressant dosage form is the transdermal dosage form. So you're able to get more of the compound into the CNS. And it becomes non-selective then, you inhibit both forms. So we're using the compounds to treat depression. And inhibit the metabolism of the norepinephrine, serotonin, and the dopamine. Again, when you inhibit the metabolism, you don't just all of a sudden see a high concentration of the neurotransmitters. Again, there's changes with the downregulation of the receptors and so on. So it's not the immediate effect that causes the therapeutic effect. Compounds that we're looking at will be irreversible inhibitors. They're considered to be suicide inhibitors. They actually form covalent bonds with the enzyme. So mechanism-based, the enzyme is trying to metabolize the compound and let it form a covalent bond, and then you can't get it off of the enzyme. The covalent bond is going to be formed in the active site. It takes a period of time to see the effect of the compound. If you inhibit the enzyme, it occurs more rapidly than the therapeutic effect. So you can get maximum inhibition for a week, but it will take you 2 to 3 weeks to see the antidepressant effect. Again, an indication that just increasing the neurotransmitters isn't the explanation for the antidepressant effect. Because we're forming those covalent bonds with the enzyme, we have to synthesize new enzymes to overcome the inhibition. So if a person's been on a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, generally you need to wait at least 2 weeks before you put them on another antidepressant. If you don't, you end up with severe drug interactions. Compounds are not totally selective from monoamine oxidase, so they can inhibit other enzymes and affect the metabolism of other compounds. And they can also cause a drug interaction with the indirect acting adrenergic compound. So if you release the neurotransmitters, then you're not going to be able to metabolize them as well. That's the problem with the tyrosine, it's an indirect acting compound. Two major problems as far as the side effects. The first one is the serotonin syndrome. Essentially what this implies is there's too much serotonin. So if you have compounds that are acting through multiple pathways to increase serotonin, you're going to have potential for drug interaction. So other antidepressants that block the reuptake, glutamine has an effect, or some other compounds have an effect. And then the other is a hypertensive problem with some of your indirect acting compounds, some of the other compounds. Serotonin syndrome, again, is a problem with a lot of the antidepressants. If you're switching therapy, again, you have to consider which compound was the person on and how long does it take to essentially put the body back to normal before you use the second one. So if you use the monoamine oxidase inhibitor first, you have to allow time for the enzyme to be resynthesized. If we use one of the SSRI compounds, we have to consider the half-life of the compound. How long is it going to take for the body to get rid of the compound? So the half-life of the drug is important. symptoms are listed here. Serotonin has a lot of different effects on the body. Problem is when you increase the amount of serotonin, it doesn't know what receptors you want it to react with. So it reacts with all seven types of serotonin receptors. You get a lot of different problems. And the hypertensive crisis is when you have indirect acting compounds that release the norepinephrine and you inhibited their its metabolism with monoamine oxidase. So as the name implies, hypertensive, you can get an increase in blood pressure. This can lead to problems like a stroke. So this is one of the major reasons why compounds aren't used very often, is when you worry about these problems like the hypertensive crisis. Indirect acting compounds can be present with decongestants or the tyramine. This is a slide I showed you. It's an amine that you find in fermented foods. If a person is not on a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, it should have been metabolized in the GI tract or in the liver and never got a chance to produce any biological effect. But if you inhibited the enzyme, now you're not metabolizing it and it can reduce its effect. You find it in a lot of different types of food. This isn't a very complete list. The problem is you can't necessarily predict how much tyramine is present in any particular food. People may have used a particular food without a problem, and then all of a sudden they get another sample that's got more tyramine present. So it varies. And usually you're looking at high protein age foods. That's what's listed. Again, you can't predict ahead of time. So the net effect is the person's on the compounds generally things, don't eat this, and this. And that's why they have a problem with using the compounds. This just gives you an example of how much tyramine you might find in different meals. And essentially, if you have like less than 40 milligrams, you shouldn't have a hypertensive problem. It's going to be higher than that. So this is just looking at different things. You'll notice some of the quantities here. Rose pork, the person's eating it, essentially pounded, so the cheeses, Jewish products. The other problem that can occur is kind of the opposite, orthostatic hypotension. One of the metabolites that you can form from the inhibited monoamine oxidase is a propylene. And this is a false neurotransmitter. It gets incorporated into the vesicles instead of norepinephrine, and then when it's released, it doesn't stimulate the receptors. So you get the decrease in blood pressure. Compounds that have a high density have the potential for hepatic toxicity. The other side effects, again, the kind of general ones that you can find with a lot of different categories of compounds. The first one here, phenolzine, is an example of the hydrazine. The hydrazine is a carbon with two nitrogens on it. And the hydrazine functional group. This undergoes oxidation, so we get a double bond between the nitrogens and then lose the nitrogens. And in this case, you form the covalent bond with the cofactor in the enzyme. It's metabolized by acetylation. Whenever you're acetylating amino groups, you've got genetic differences in people. You have fast and slow acetylators. People that are slow acetylators have more of the active compound, so they may respond better. People that are fast acetylators may have more of a problem with hepatotoxicity. The second compound is prodrug. What happens is this group that's attached to the nitrogen is removed by hydrolysis. And now we then have the hydrogen. The only difference is it's one part of the shorter than the previous one. But same mechanism, you then oxidize it and form the chromium bond with the coenzyme.